Jeffrey Epstein. The name on everybody's lips, and apparently in the inbox of scores of politicians, celebrities, and business tycoons. Nearly 7 years after the man was found dead in his prison cell, we're still peeling back the onion layers of his vast and complex operation. The Epstein files have been dripping out for months now and represent a vast amount of information about the man, his associates, and how his operation was able to run with such relative smoothness for so long. This was a man whose depravity will mark him as one of those notorious figures in history. Sex crimes against children, a dangerous thirst for power, and a darkness that has already engulfed countless lives. So, let's take a look at some of the most depraved shit from the Epstein files, shall we? Perhaps the most depraved aspect of the Epstein files is not a single story or a single victim, but the fact that this shocking conveyor belt of horror was carried out with the precision and single-mindedness of a multi-million dollar company. It was slick, highly organized, and we're still only just beginning to understand it all. At its center was, of course, Jeffrey Epstein, the big dog. But fade out from there, and you find a tight web with numerous people involved. Ghislaine Maxwell, Epstein's partner, who's currently serving a 20-year sentence for child sex trafficking and connected offenses, functioned as a chief operator. She would help recruit, groom, and manage underage girls, train them in how to behave, and act as an intermediary between Epstein and his victims. In her trial, one victim said that Maxwell had opened the door to hell. Then you have Sarah Kellen, born Sarah Kensington, a former interior designer who started working for Epstein in the early 2000s, initially as an assistant in his Manhattan office. However, numerous allegations claim that she also played a fundamental role in what was happening behind closed doors. Her responsibilities reportedly included scheduling massages, coordinating travel for victims, greeting them at properties, leading them to their rooms, and preparing spaces for whatever was going on. However, quite remarkably, she has never been charged with anything, and to rub salt into the wounds, she even applied for and received compensation from the Epstein Victims Compensation Program, asserting that she was also a victim of his abuse. She currently owns luxury property in both New York and Florida, valued at a combined $11 million, so she's not doing too bad compared to some of the other victims. Alongside her was Leslie Groff, who apparently looked after the girl's living needs as well as maintaining the rules of behavior, allegedly. Nadia Marcinko, also known as Nada Marcinkova, whose responsibilities range from piloting Epstein's Boeing 727-100 aircraft, referred to as the Lolita Express, more on that later, and general assistant who sometimes took part in the depraved activities, allegedly. One victim testified that Epstein told her that he had bought Marcinko from her parents in Czechoslovakia in the 1990s. If anyone else said something like that, it would sound far-fetched, but this was Jeffrey Epstein. Jean-Luc Brunel was an evil little man who was investigated by Diane Sawyer in 60 Minutes over wide-ranging allegations that he used to routinely drug and rape women in the Paris modeling world in the 1980s and 90s, but again, no charges were ever brought. Probably no surprise that he fell in love with Epstein's crowd in the 2000s, with Virginia Giuffre accusing Brunel of having sexually trafficked girls for Epstein for years. Brunel put out a statement saying, "I strongly deny having committed any illicit acts or any wrongdoing in the course of my work as a scouter or model agency's manager." End quote. The fact that flight logs suggest he made no fewer than 25 trips aboard Epstein's plane might suggest otherwise. Allegedly, he was finally arrested in 2020 and charged with sexual offenses, but he hanged himself in his cell in 2022. According to one report in the files, on Epstein's birthday, 12-year-old triplets were flown over from France for his pleasure. It's not clear whether Brunel was the giftee, but the sheer number of horrid stories involving this man means his suicide was widely welcomed, let's say. Darren Indyke was Epstein's lawyer, and while there's little in terms of direct links with the most sordid behavior, he has been sued for aiding, abetting, and facilitating Epstein's sex trafficking operation by helping him build a massively successful company. He also received a nice $50 million in Epstein's will, the largest of any beneficiary. Probably says a lot, doesn't it? Allegedly. Richard Kahn was the accountant who kept the insidious operation ticking over and no doubt sheltered it from prying eyes. Epstein liked to pay with cash as much as possible for obvious reasons, and Kahn was the man to ensure that there was always plenty of dirty Benjamins at hand. Both Kahn and Indyke have been subpoenaed for more information on Epstein as of February 2026, and things might not work out so well for them depending on how far the FBI want to go. These were the leading players, but below that was an ecosystem where people had to know what was going on. Drivers transported girls between properties, airports, and residences. Some testified that they didn't realize ages or purposes, while others acknowledged that they had an inkling, but never knew the full scope. And then you've got to think about housekeepers, cleaners, guards, and probably many more that we didn't even think about. This wasn't just one evil man operating in the shadows. This was a fully functioning operation with a wide array of characters with clearly defined roles. Of all that's been said about Epstein, his island of horror, and the maniacal system that kept it all running, we've never heard anything about murder. That is until the most recent file drop. Now, we need to tread very carefully here. All of this is completely unverified at this point. All of this is very alleged. Allegations, just covering all my bases here, by a redacted source, have been made that a young girl was sadistically tortured and ultimately murdered on Epstein Island. At this stage, there's nothing else to go on, but survivors have reported being told that people who caused problems disappeared on the island. It was made perfectly clear to them that they were far from formal jurisdiction and that island law was administered by those who had brought them there. Conspiracy theories surrounding Epstein Island have run wild since the name came to light in 2019. Everything from secret graves on the island, rooms built specifically for torture and ultimately execution, and numerous missing people linked to Jeffrey Epstein, allegedly. The official police narrative is that none of that was found on the island, but at this point, there are plenty of people who don't believe the official narrative. Was a young girl really tortured and killed on the island? Skeptics will tell you it's unlikely and there's no hard evidence, but those are probably the same people who told you back in 2019 that a secret island where the rich and famous could come to have sex with underage girls was conspiracy theory waffle. Not all of Epstein's horrors took place on the ground. In 2001, as with many people with more money than they know what to do with, Jeffrey Epstein purchased an aircraft, a Boeing 727-100, to be exact. The aircraft had minor modifications, including a forward salon with a home theater, a mid-cabin lounge and galley, and a private aft stateroom equipped with a queen-size bed and an ensuite lavatory. And this is where the story of this particular Boeing 727-100 deviates quite dramatically from others. It eventually got the nickname the Lolita Express because it had a tendency to arrive with a gaggle of worryingly young-looking women. Flight logs entered into evidence showed the aircraft was used frequently, with trips between New York, Florida, New Mexico, the US Virgin Islands, and international destinations. Epstein personally logged 600 hours on board the aircraft a year, often with guests on board. But the thing is, this wasn't used simply to get from A to B. Numerous testimonies and new information from the Epstein files have talked about sex parties with minors on board the aircraft organized by Epstein's fixer-in-chief, Ghislaine Maxwell. And all of the flight logs are publicly available. Usually it includes specific names, but scan through carefully and you'll notice countless flights that include one woman or two women. Some big names jump out at you. Bill Clinton reportedly flew on the aircraft 27 times. Naomi Campbell, Kevin Spacey, Chris Tucker, and while the name Donald Trump doesn't appear in the logs, several have stated that he flew on the Lolita Express more than once. Epstein once told author Michael Wolff that Trump had first consummated his new relationship with Melania while on board the plane. Pilots Larry Vysotsky and David Rogers appear repeatedly in records as regular crew members, and both testified in legal proceedings. They describe flying Epstein and his guests for years, with Vysotsky acknowledging seeing young girls on flights, though he said he did not know their ages or circumstances. The Lolita Express became a key part of the large case against Epstein and Maxwell. If you want to traffic people, one of the biggest issues is transportation. Airports ask for passports and eventually begin to put two and two together. But when you've got your own private plane, you simply park on the runway of a remote airfield and step aboard. No TSA, no passports, no questions. Jeffrey Epstein owned numerous properties across the world, but none became as notorious as Little St. James, the island that he purchased in the 1990s. The island is small, roughly 70 to 78 acres, and is part of the United States Virgin Islands. It has a main house, three guest cottages, a caretaker cottage, a private desalination system, a helipad, and a dock, but Epstein was constantly upgrading things. The most recent photos from the island show what can only be described as a bizarre temple with a classic synagogue design. Did Epstein find God amidst rampant sex offending? Well, who knows, but I'm going to guess the answer is no. In 2008, Epstein's estate on Little St. James had 70 staff who all had to sign non-disclosure agreements, and now we know why. Little St. James, also referred to as Epstein Island, Orgy Island, P-word Island, the Isle of Babes, and perhaps most appropriately, the Island of Sin, was the setting of events that still haven't fully come to light. But the Epstein files have given us a glimpse. There are reported mentions of underage orgies with one very surprising name connected in one document, Stephen Hawking. Yes, the brilliant scientist with ALS who always talked through a robotic voice generator. There was an email where Epstein appeals to a friend, Virginia Giuffre, to disprove allegations of Giuffre's that Hawking had been involved in an orgy. To be clear, Giuffre never accused Hawking of anything, but his inclusion is without a doubt the weirdest name in the Epstein files. Testimony from people working at the control tower at the St. Thomas airfield, where the Lolita Express would arrive, claimed that girls, who often looked 16 or under, were coming and going from the island. They were often wearing baggy college sweaters and carrying designer shopping bags. Several victims stated that they were flown to the island aboard his plane, sometimes without clear information about where they were going, for how long, or who would be present. Once there, they described being surrounded by staff, guests, and guards with no independent means of leaving. Search warrants executed in 2019 recovered electronic devices, documents, and other materials from the islands, along with some pretty bizarre stuff. Creepy masks, a dentist's chair, ghoulish art, often with half-naked girls in, a blackboard that had the words power and deception written on it, stuffed animals, and a room with firefighter gear and police uniforms, which I'm guessing weren't used for health and safety training days. And there were also sex toys. Lots and lots of sex toys, sometimes neatly stored in a cupboard alongside large bottles of lube, but on one occasion simply left out on the living room table. Creepy, and yet there's another aspect of the house that sends chills down the spine, and that's the framed photographs on the walls, on desks, littered around the house. In the images, the faces have been redacted, which means these are almost certainly photographs of his victims that he chose to decorate his home with. Even away from the island, images from Epstein's other properties leave you with that taste in the mouth, that feeling that tells you bad things are almost certainly going to have occurred here. And that is no more apparent than in his townhouse in Manhattan, where guests were greeted by a statue in a wedding dress hung from a noose tied to the ceiling. And to top it all off, it appeared that Jeffrey Epstein had the kind of interior design taste that screams, "I've got money and absolutely no clue." Bizarre sandstone statues, peculiar face sculptures on walls, and plastic legs protruding in the bathroom. But then again, if you were going to guess how the international head of a P-word ring might decorate his home, it would probably be something like this. Financing an international sex trafficking organization on this scale was always gonna be a bit complicated, but thankfully, Epstein had Richard Kahn, who we met earlier. In 2023, JP Morgan, with which Epstein banked between 1998 and 2013, agreed to an astonishing $290 million settlement with his abuse victims after it was made clear that the bank turned a blind eye to internal memos that raised significant red flags about Epstein and what he was up to. I'm not going to say that JP Morgan chose not to cut ties with a valuable customer, even though he was in the sex trafficking industry, but if you're willing to hand over nearly $300 million, it does reek of accountability. Or perhaps lack thereof, allegedly, in my opinion. And there's more. A year after Epstein's death, Deutsche Bank reached a $150 million settlement with New York regulators, while also shelling out $75 million to settle lawsuits. And in the US, Bank of America is the largest bank to come under fire, with one victim, with her identity protected, saying, "Rather than merely providing routine banking services to Epstein, Bank of America went far beyond what a non-complicit bank would have done and instead assisted Epstein in setting up the necessary financial structure to operate his sex trafficking venture." And that is a quote from someone else that we are just repeating. Not our opinion. So, which suspicious payments raised flags but were ignored then? Well, the investigation into Epstein's finances is complicated and murky, and it'll probably be several years before a clear picture emerges. However, recent releases have highlighted the widespread use of hush money to silence victims. The payments were often disguised as university scholarships, even when the girl in question was still several years from university age, or they were modeling contracts that were sometimes connected with Jean-Luc Brunel and agencies in Europe. This was essentially what Jeffrey Epstein and his band of enablers did time and time again when a victim caused a fuss. It was quick, simple, and for years it shielded him from prosecution. One email from the latest batch of releases gives an insight into Epstein's shady business dealings away from his personal massages. In it, he discusses with an unknown associate the possibility of trying to gain access to Libya's frozen state funds, including plans to help from former British and Israeli intelligence figures. The message, dated July 2011, was sent months after a NATO-backed revolt began against Libya's longtime leader, Muammar Gaddafi, who was later killed by rebel forces in October that year. In the email, the sender claimed that roughly $80 billion in Libyan assets were frozen worldwide, with about $32.4 billion held in the United States alone. But it was believed that the total amount, plus misappropriations and stolen Libyan assets, might amount to 3 to 4 times that. The sender said, quoting, "If we can locate or recover even 5 to 10% of these funds and secure a fee of 10 to 25%, the numbers quickly reach into the billions." End quote. Whether this actually happens, we've got no idea, but it just adds another intriguing layer to the Epstein story. He wasn't just a sex offender, he wasn't just the head of a P-word ring, he was involved with deals at the highest levels across the world and in a number of industries. So how do you run an organization like this for so long and basically get away with it all? Well, one of the most consistent details across the Epstein files is the language used to disguise abuse. Again and again, victims describe being told they were being hired to give a massage with absolutely no other pretense to go along with it. For underage girls, many of whom had never had formal jobs, the idea of being paid for a massage did not immediately register as a warning sign. Many young girls went along to one of these properties, genuinely believing that all they needed to do was rub a man's shoulders for an hour and that would be it. I know it sounds painfully naive, but let's be honest. We've all been young, and we've all believed things that in hindsight we really probably shouldn't have. According to testimony, the setup followed a familiar pattern. A girl would be instructed to go to a private residence, sometimes alone or with others. She would be shown to a room, given minimal guidance, and told to begin. According to multiple accounts, what happened next involved progressive boundary violations rather than sudden force. He wouldn't immediately jump on girls. Instead, each step tested whether the girl would object, leave, or comply. Money was handed over at the end, often without discussion, and higher payments were given when certain boundaries had been crossed. And that's one of the most disturbing parts of this whole story, because once you've handed over cash to a minor who has just had sex with an adult, it creates this awful sense of complicity. The cover story also helped insulate others. Drivers, staff, and visitors could plausibly claim they believed girls were present for legitimate services, which sounds absolutely absurd, but that's actually how it went. The word massage created just enough distance to dull suspicion without inviting questions. Once girls left the room, they were typically met by Maxwell or one of the other assistants, who would often throw a loving arm around them, ask them whether they were okay and whether they wanted to do that again. Some said yes, some said no. For those who came back repeatedly, they were often asked to find other girls for money, a self-fulfilling perverted catch-22 where Epstein and his accomplices had a steady stream of new girls arriving at his properties. Most people who have been associated with Epstein have managed to weasel their way out through the mud, at least for now. But for two men in the United Kingdom, rock bottom is a term that requires reassessment each time a new cache of materials hits the newsstands. The first is a man you'll all know, the disgrace of the British monarchy, brother to King Charles, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, formerly Prince Andrew. As of early 2026, there hasn't been a public figure who has been savaged by the Epstein files quite like Andrew. Rewind to 2010 and his life was going swimmingly, but in 2011, Virginia Giuffre alleged that Epstein had forced her to have sex with the prince. And while these allegations never really got out into the public, it was only a matter of time. In 2015, the metaphorical royal shit hit the fan when her testimony was included in US federal court filings, and in 2019, when the name Epstein reared its ugly head, the focus fell heavily on Andrew. Andrew then decided that the best course of action was to give an interview on BBC Newsnight, which backfired intensely. From there, it's been a steady sinking ship. In 2022, he settled a lawsuit brought by Giuffre out of court, which, let's face it, it's never a good look. Prince Andrew then became, well, just Mr. Andrew after his royal title was stripped, and he's even been forced to move into a humble abode known as Marsh Farm. And then came the last files and images of Andrew kneeling on all fours over a woman on the ground. He's dressed in a t-shirt and jogging bottoms. It doesn't look like he's there in an official capacity. Emails have also emerged showing that he handed over documents to Epstein that he was using as a trade envoy to Asian countries, including one about investment opportunities in the reconstruction of Helmand Province in Afghanistan. Could it get any worse for the poor prince? Well, maybe. If the British government and monarchy force him to testify in the US, things could get oh so very bad indeed. Next up is Peter Mandelson. Now, that name almost certainly isn't as well known, but this scandal has exploded in the UK in recent weeks after email correspondence between him and Epstein came to light. And just a quick background about Mandelson: long-term politician who really reached his peak under Tony Blair, who disappeared for a while, and now we know where, before coming back and taking the role as British ambassador to the US. His name has long been linked to Epstein, largely because he acknowledged that Epstein loaned him some money in 2008. However, over the past few months, a steady drip of information has tarnished his name, culminating in what appears to be Mandelson passing government information to Epstein regarding a range of issues. Mandelson also helped an investment banker friend of Epstein to secure a deal with the UK government, which again, not a brilliant look. Mandelson is sliding downhill and gathering speed. The police are investigating, and he has been exiled from the Labour Party. He might not be the number one national disgrace just yet, but he is catching up. Now, years before anybody was really talking about Jeffrey Epstein, the courts had an opportunity to send him down for a considerable amount of time and really fuck it up. In 2006, Epstein was arrested in Florida in connection with 36 acts of sex with minors, some as young as 14. At this point, the investigation had been ongoing for nearly 2 years, during which the Palm Beach police and the FBI uncovered a massive amount of information. The number of minors connected eventually climbed above 50, with one report suggesting that Epstein would have 3 massages a day and the girls would be paid between $300 and $600 for their services. In the prosecution world, this was pretty much a slam dunk case. But it wasn't. Firstly, we need to point out why the FBI got involved in the first place, because the Palm Beach police believed the Palm Beach Prosecution Service was strangely reluctant to pursue Epstein. We have no idea why, but I bet a few of you can guess. Even after the FBI stepped in, it seemed like Epstein was looking at a long stretch of time in jail. And you know what happens to P-words in prison. But that's not what actually happened. Somehow, the vast majority of the cases were virtually dismissed after a plea deal was reached between Epstein and the Southern District of Florida that also halted the federal investigation and shielded potential co-conspirators. Epstein pled guilty to one count of felony solicitation of prostitution and one count of procuring a person under 18 for prostitution and served a cozy 18 months with plenty of work release thrown in. This meant he, quite astonishingly, was allowed to leave jail for 12 hours per day to work from his office. And they say that rich people get special treatments in prison. What a lie. Alexander Acosta, the then U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Florida, reportedly said that he gave Epstein a lenient plea deal because he was informed that the next was intelligence and advised to back off. As if all of that wasn't stomach-turning enough, recent documents released shed light on Epstein's brazen efforts to clean his 2008 conviction from the public sphere as much as possible. The man involved, according to email correspondence, was Al Sekel, a writer and apparently part-time SEO expert whom Epstein paid tens of thousands of dollars to downrank stories about his conviction and remove toxic suggested search engine terms. He also said he had successfully hacked Wikipedia to remove mugshots and pushed any mention of the 2008 conviction to the bottom of the page. Hacking Wikipedia. Anyone can edit Wikipedia. After a somewhat cryptic message after Epstein complained about the cost of the job, he said bluntly, "You have a dedicated group of people trying to undo and damage you." And there's more on this. According to a heavily redacted report from an FBI informant, Jeffrey Epstein also hired an elite-level hacker from southern Italy who developed and marketed zero-day software exploits, which essentially meant software that could sneak into widely used systems, allegedly. There's a lot that remains completely mysterious about this report, especially as half of it is redacted, but it's believed that Epstein employed this hacker to assist with the disinformation campaign to clean his image. And that might not have been it. Did Epstein also use this hacker to infiltrate phones and computers of those he was compiling dirt on? The name Vincenzo Iozzo appears in multiple times in Epstein's emails, referring to a world-renowned hacker who in 2010 became the first person to hack the iPhone. Is this the redacted name? Is this all connected? Maybe. We don't know. Yet. One of the most shocking aspects of the Epstein files has nothing to do with what's in them, but rather how it was all done. By law, victims of Jeffrey Epstein's abuse must have their identities protected, which meant faces blurred from images and names and personal information redacted from all documents they appeared in. That safeguard existed for a reason. Many of the women involved had spent years rebuilding private lives after trauma, often under assurances from the justice system that anonymity would remain intact. Simple. And yet we are talking about millions of documents and a ravenous public who can't wait to see the latest scandalous news. Hello there, you watching this video. The result, a spectacularly rushed job. When the files went live, nearly 100 survivor names appeared without redaction. First names, last names, sometimes both. In some cases, contextual details made identification blatantly obvious. The disclosure spread quickly, amplified by social media, and suddenly the names of the abused were out for all to see. Legal representatives reacted immediately, and attorneys for survivors filed emergency motions describing the failure as life-threatening. Many spoke of their fear of harassment, stalking, retaliation, and renewed public exposure. Ben there were the inevitable conspiracy theorists and online mobs eager to dissect their lives for entertainment. An emergency agreement followed, with the Department of Justice committing to scrubbing exposed identities as quickly as possible and removing improperly released material from public access. Guys, the horse has left the fucking stable. Thousands of documents disappeared from the DOJ website in the days that followed, which was a start, but considering the names had already been on view for days, it wasn't much consolation to Epstein's victims. And we'll finish today with the sheer magnitude of Jeffrey Epstein and his complicated web of associates linked to him by the Epstein files. Of course, we do need to say that just because a name appears in an email with Epstein doesn't necessarily mean that they were aware of the heinous actions going on. As well as a rampant child abuser, rapist, and all-around evil human being, Epstein was also a businessman, and there are undoubtedly many connected to him who did business with him and very little else. Okay, now that we've got that disclaimer out of the way, let's dive in, because the Epstein files have revealed thousands of names, many of whom are as big as they get. In terms of political prestige, from both sides of the aisle, you don't get much bigger than Trump and Clinton, with both men appearing frequently. Woody Allen, Steve Bannon, Noam Chomsky, Bill Cosby, David Copperfield, Mette Marit, Crown Princess of Norway, Sarah Ferguson, Robert Mugabe, Elon Musk, Harvey Weinstein, and Jay-Z. The list is astonishing, and while connections can range from being mentioned by a defendant to witnessing the island to simply an email correspondence, association sticks like tar. The point is that Epstein's connections stretched far and wide to all corners of the planet. He communicated with high-level Russian politicians as well as their Western counterparts in Europe and the US. He was on a casually friendly basis with huge names in banking, tech, and finance. He had connections to royal families, scientists, philanthropists, and artists. It seemed there were few avenues where Jeffrey Epstein wasn't well connected. The question everybody has long asked is why? Was it a simple yet elaborate web of control and influence? He often seemed interested in connecting certain people with other people, but what did he gain from it all? Was it all about the money? Or was it all about the power? One theory, as old as the Epstein saga itself, is that it was a giant honeypot system where he nurtured relationships with the rich, the famous, and the powerful, invited them to one of his properties, and then casually asked if they wanted to have a little fun. Then he would have images, videos, and compromising material gathered during the act, which would be used to exert influence over said person. This sort of thing isn't new, but something on this scale would be unprecedented. As we know, Jeffrey Epstein died in his cell in August 2019, officially suicide by hanging. Yet there are enough bizarrely coincidental facts that mean that the official narrative has long been questioned. Both guards claimed they fell asleep that night and then tried to falsify records. The cameras weren't working outside his cell. His neck had numerous broken bones in it, which the coroner attributed to Epstein having hurled himself from the top bunk. His defense attorney, however, has long stated that the injuries looked more like homicide than suicide. If this was a honeypot system, did Epstein anger the wrong bear who pulled a few strings and ordered the hit? Or did he really tie a noose around his neck and jump from the top bunk? Despite millions of pages, emails, images, and videos that have so far been released as part of the Epstein files, it still feels like we're standing at the bottom of a mountain, craning our heads to see what's at the top. The problem is that the top is just constantly shrouded by moving clouds. All these documents have still only revealed a fraction of the picture. We may have a good idea about the victims, thanks to their bravery in coming forward, but we have no idea who Jeffrey Epstein really was. Mossad agents, international crime puppeteer, businessman with a vile side who did anything to further his own ends, the man pulling the strings behind some of the major decisions and events around the world? It's difficult to know where to go and how far down the rabbit hole to disappear. What we do know is that he certainly headed a sophisticated sex operation that fulfilled his own seedy needs and those of others around him. We know he had a shocking level of cruelty and depravity, a monster in the truest sense, but you get the feeling it's so much worse than we know. Thank you for watching.